This is fresh air. In his latest book, Deep Down Dark, novelist and Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Hector Tobar recounts the full story of a disaster that many of us know only the ending of. Our book critic Maureen Carrigan has a review.
The disaster began on a day shift around lunchtime at a mine in Chile's Atacama Desert. Miners working deep inside a mountain, excavating for copper, gold, and other minerals, started feeling vibrations. Suddenly, there was a massive explosion, and the passageways of the mine filled up with a gritty dust cloud. When the dust settled, the men discovered the source of the explosion. A single block of stone, as tall as a 45-story building, had broken off from the rest of the mountain and had fallen through the layers of the mine, causing a chain reaction as the mountain above it began collapsing too. 33 miners were sealed inside the mountain by this mega block of stone, some 770,000 tons of it, twice the weight of the Empire State Building. Staring at that smooth wall, Luis Orsua, the crew's supervisor, thought, it was like the stone they put over Jesus' tomb. If the beginning of this horror tale seems the stuff of legend or nightmare, the conclusion is reassuringly familiar because some 1 billion of us viewers around the world watched it unfold on live TV. On October 13, 2010, all 33 of those Chilean miners trapped for 69 days inside the San Jose mine were raised to the surface of the earth, resurrected through a newly drilled escape tunnel into which a capsule was slowly lowered and raised by a giant crane. It was a feat of engineering and a triumph of faith. Neither the miners buried under half a mile of rock, nor their families above ground in a makeshift tent city called Campo Esperanza, Camp Hope, ever completely succumbed to despair, despite the fact that for 17 days before a drill finally broke through to the refuge, the room where the men were gathered, no one knew whether they were alive or not. Before they left the refuge, all 33 men recognized that their story was their most precious possession and agreed to share the proceeds of any book or movie made about them. The movie, starring Antonio Banderas and Juliette Binoche, is in the works. The book has just come out. It's called Deep Down Dark, and it's written by Hector Tobar. As real-life extreme adventure tales go, this one is a doozy, the equal, if the geographical inverse, of Into Thin Air, Jon Krakauer's 1999 blockbuster about the Mount Everest climbing disaster. Tobar had exclusive access to the miners, and while that kind of snug situation inevitably places some constraints on a storyteller, Tobar complicates the purely uplifting version of the men's ordeal, describing occasional resentments and petty thievery. Nonetheless, the most inspiring aspect of the miners' behavior was their almost immediate decision to act in solidarity. On the first day of their entombment, Supervisor Orsua took off his distinctive white helmet and announced to his workers, "We are all equal now. There are no bosses and employees." Some of the miners regarded Orsua's act as an abdication of responsibility. Others saw it as a crucial factor that inspired their collective behavior and survival. The men organized themselves into work shifts, participated in daily prayer sessions, and rationed their emergency food supply into one meal a day of two cookies and a spoonful of tuna fish, augmented by water drained from industrial waste containers. Above ground, the mostly female crowd of the miners' families acted collectively too, banging pots and pans to get attention and shouting, "We want information," in police officers' faces. Tobar occasionally inserts poetic commentary into this narrative, such as when he says of the first moments of the miners' entombment that the outside has slipped into the was, because now the men live in a present and perhaps a forever of darkness. Mostly, though, Tobar wisely sticks to the journalistic method of marshaling as many details of the claustrophobic horror as he can to make the mine and the men's ordeal vivid to the reader. He succeeds. You're made of sterner stuff than I am if, as a reader, you can keep from tearing up at that glorious moment on day 17 when engineers on the surface draw up that rescue drill and discover a note tied to the bit that reads, "We are well in the refuge," signed the 33.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University and is the author of the new book, So We Read On, How the Great Gatsby Came to Be and Why It Endures. She reviewed Deep Down Dark by Hector Tobar. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Sam Brigger, Lauren Krenzel, John Myers, John Sheehan, Heidi Simon, and Teresa Madden. I'm Terry Gross.
Literature comes alive at the Poetry Center at the 92nd Street Y in New York City. It's home to this country's most famous reading series. This week marks the 75th anniversary of the first writer to appear there. It was William Carlos Williams. The Poetry Center is celebrating its Diamond Jubilee by digging into its archives of audio recordings and posting some of them online for free. Tom Vitale has more.
Cynthia Ozick was in her 20s, fresh out of grad school, when her husband bought her a $20 season subscription to the reading series at the 92nd Street Y. There, she heard T.S. Eliot, Dylan Thomas, Marianne Moore, and W.H. Auden. She calls the time the age of colossal poets, and she says the 92nd Street Y was their cathedral.
You sat there and you saw these icons standing in a blaze of brilliant spotlight, and you felt that you were at the crux of all civilization in the 92nd Street Y in the 1950s, or so it struck me then, when I was sitting there and thinking, I want to be a writer.
I'm happy to give you W.H. Auden.
Auden took the lectern at the Y's cavernous mahogany-paneled theater in 1951 to read his poem In Praise of Limestone.
If it form the one landscape that we, the inconstant ones, are consistently homesick for, this is chiefly because it dissolves in water,
Odin's poem is part of the anniversary project called 75 at 75, pairing 75 of the Poetry Center's rarest recordings with contemporary essays. Cynthia Ozick wrote about hearing Odin.
There was something in his voice which made everything intimate because it was a conversation, even though there he was standing up in this enormously brilliant light. And that came about, I think, because of the way he read in this absolutely flat, monotone, sort of commonsensical, as if he were not reading lyric lines of poetry.
Not to lose time, not to get caught, not to be left behind, not pleased to resemble the beasts who repeat themselves, or a thing like water or stone whose conduct can be predicted.
Odin was one of the first writers to be recorded at the Y, even though the series began more than a decade earlier. And the Poetry Center's archives capture some of this country's best-known writers at the beginnings of their careers. In 1953, Eudora Welty read from her first book, her signature short story, Why I Live at the P.O.
I was getting along fine with Mama, Papa, Daddy, and Uncle Rondo until my sister Stella Rondo just separated from her husband and came back home again, Mr. Whitaker. Of course, I went with Mr. Whitaker first when he first appeared here in China Grove taking pose yourself photos, and Stella Rondo broke us up. Told him I was one-sided, bigger on one side than the other, which is a deliberate, calculated falsehood. I'm the same.
This was a time before writers were expected to do book tours and in-store readings. Novelist T.C. Boyle is used to that sort of thing, but he says the celebrated writer John Cheever wasn't.
He is an awkward reader. He doesn't pause for the audience to catch up and enjoy the sly wit of this wonderful story. And yet, it doesn't really matter to me. it's a thrill to hear John giving his performance.
Boyle wrote the essay that accompanies Cheever's 1964 reading of one of his most famous stories, The Death of Justina. It's about a Westchester man whose wife's cousin dies in his living room, but when he tries to arrange for her funeral, he's told his posh part of town is not zoned for dying.
For Christ's sake, I said. Yes, yes, he said, it is difficult, but after all, you must realize that this is the world you live in, and the importance of zoning can't be overestimated. Why, if a single member of the council could give out zoning exceptions, I could give you permission right now to open a saloon in your garage, put up neon lights, hire an orchestra, and destroy the neighborhood and all the human and commercial values we've worked so hard to protect.
The voices themselves take us back to another time, says T.C. Boyle, hearing writers reading their own work, giving their own version in their own accent and their own rhythms is always a revelation.
It's thrilling. It puts you in that audience, even though these things occurred sometimes before you were even born. It allows us to touch the past in a way that the words on the page don't exactly touch the past in quite this way, because you don't have the human presence and the human voice behind them.
One of those voices belonged to Dylan Thomas, born 100 years ago today, who premiered his play Under Milkwood at the 92nd Street Y in 1953.
The beginning, at the beginning. It is spring, moonless night in the small town. Starless and Bible black, the cobble streets silent, and the hunched quarters and rabbit's wood limping invisible down to the slow black, crow black fishing boat bobbing sea.
For NPR News, I'm Tom Vitale in New York.
And all the people of the loud and dumbfound town are sleeping now. Hush, the babies are sleeping, the farmers, the fishers, the tradesmen and pensioners.
Next, we have movie recommendations from James Ellroy. He's the author of crime novels like L.A. Confidential, including real historical characters of Los Angeles. Ellroy's newest, Perfidia, portrays some of the same characters, cops, on December 7th, 1941. Of course, the L.A. landscape he portrays includes the movie industry, which Ellroy is part of. He's writing a remake of the 1944 film Laura Now. So we asked Ellroy to suggest some films for our series, Watch This. His picks include Stray Dog from the Japanese director Akira Kurosawa.
Stray Dog is a 1949 movie with a very young Toshiro Mifune. It's bombed out Tokyo in a heat wave.
Oh, after World War II?
After World War II. The place is a ruin. It's the ruins of Athens or Carthage or Pompeii. And he's on a subway and he's dozing. He's a handsome guy. He's wearing a white suit. He's a police detective. a desiccated lowlife steals his gun.
Mm-hmm.
He spends the rest of the movie looking for this guy. It's the story of emasculated Japan in the wake of World War II. He is on the path, the trail, the quest, Mifune is, for self-vindication. And in vindicating himself, he vindicates all of Japan.
Now, there is something that marks a memorable movie. The plot is, in its way, very simple, but you can see how it's profound and how you could, while this guy is trying to chase down the man who stole his gun, anything could happen. It's like the bicycle thief.
Yes, it's very much like the bicycle thief. He's out there. He's looking for his Roscoe, his peace. His identity is a policeman. And it's not picaresque. It's not a Shaggy Dog story. There is a plot.
You also sent us another Kurosawa movie, High and Low. What's that?
High and Low may be the greatest crime movie I've ever seen. It's the most beautifully filmed, certainly. Yokohama, 1963. Here's what happened. It's Mifune again. He still looks good. He's a shoe magnet in the throes of a corporate takeover. His beloved son is kidnapped. The cops are called in. But wait, it's not his son. The doofus kidnapper snatched the chauffeur's kid. The first 45 or 50 minutes of this movie are shot in Mifune's big living room. And there's a large picture window that looks out and down on the slums of Yokohama.
Hmm.
And not a lot happens except men moving in cliques and talking in low voices as their world burns down. We gradually get the sense that the kidnapper looking up from the slums of Yokohama has a telescope or some kind of device fixed on that window.
Wow.
It's a stunning revelation, 45 or 50 minutes into the film.
You know, it's amazing to think about a sequence like that and wonder what it is about the self-confidence of a filmmaker that would cause him or her to say, I can do the entire first 45 minutes of this movie, and it's going to be one scene, basically, one location, and I'm going to have the confidence I'll carry the audience through to whatever happens afterward.
It's a supremely controlled motion picture. It's a long motion picture, and it flies by.
You have sent us on this list quite a few movies from the 1940s, and this is another, Brief Encounter, David Lean.
It's my favorite David Lean film, and I can't separate it from the soundtrack, which is entirely Sergei Rachmaninoff's Second Piano Concerto.
Hmm.
Played low, played throbbing, played monotonously, while Trevor Howard, a married man, Celia Johnson, a married woman, four kids between them, they meet, they fall in love.
They're both married, not to each other.
Not to each other. But this is the big love for both of them. And it's what they do and what they forfeit and what they gain. All to the soundtrack. Dun, 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 dun. Low, somber, sonorous, tragically beautiful, monotonous.
Now, on the surface, this sounds like a different film than most of the others you have recommended to us because the others, they're crime films.
All drama to me is a man meets a woman. And this might be a good point to segue to Jacques Tourneur's film Out of the Past.
This is 1947, post-war,
yeah,
post-World War II.
1947, and it's a man meets a woman writ very large. Kathy Moffat, portrayed by Jane Greer, plugs her lover, the gangster Wit, played by Kirk Douglas, gloms 40K from him and absconds down to Acapulco. She's the dangerous woman. But, Robert Mitchum as Jeff Bailey is looking to take the fall. And when you're looking to take the fall for a woman, nothing else matters. Get it, Daddy-O? It's the big noir sewer, and you're going for the big ride. There's lots of haunting, doomed voiceover narration. Of course, it goes bad. Mm. Everyone dies.
So these are all love stories, actually, that you've set us, even when people are being killed left and right.
Yeah, as someone once said back when I was a kid in the early 60s, I want to find the guy who invented sex and ask him what he's working on now. It's a good one.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah.
Do you need to stay away from movies when you're writing?
No, I'll go to a movie if I want to see it.
And it doesn't influence the tone of what you don't come back and suddenly you're writing in a different way, in some way that maybe you wouldn't like.
No. I don't read many novels because I write them and I want them to be perfect. And I can't tolerate imperfection when I read fiction. And how often do you see perfection? But going to the movies, you've got a good story, a crime, a man meets a woman. You can always go to look, and it's only going to cost you $10 in 2 hours.
James Elroy, a pleasure talking with you.
Always, Steve, always. God bless you.
His newest novel is Perfidia. It's Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
In this Halloween season, we turn our attention now to witches. Today, when you think of witches, maybe you conjure up the warm and fuzzy Hermione Granger of Harry Potter, or maybe the Wiccan priestess who works at the neighborhood coffee shop. Our next guest is going to take us back to a time when just being accused of witchcraft was enough to get you killed. Catherine Howe has put together a new compilation of writings from the 16th and 17th centuries, looking at why these accusations took root. Howe is an author and the editor of the Penguin Book of Witches. She's long been intrigued with colonial America, but witches, well, that part of her fascination is personal.
There are a couple of witches hiding on the family tree. There is a couple of witch leaves, dark curled leaves on the family tree. One of them was Elizabeth Howe, who has the same last name as me. She was actually put to death towards the beginning of the Salem crisis. She lived in Topsfield, Massachusetts.
Wow.
Yeah. The other one was Elizabeth Proctor, who was supposed to be condemned to death. But fortunately, her sentence was commuted because she was expecting a baby.
Can you just lay the groundwork? What was the culture like? What was happening that made the conditions ripe for these trials?
The early modern period was kind of the peak for witch trials. So that's from the 1500s, give or take, through the 1600s. It was a time of scarcity. And so much of witchcraft anxiety has to do with goods and services in everyday life, and also having to do with relationships. Because if you're living in an early modern frontier village, as many people were, as people in Salem Village were, for instance, you are totally dependent on trading with your neighbors and on goodwill of your neighbors in order to survive. And so you would guard your reputation very carefully.
But this was, in large part, a feminine phenomenon, right?
It was. The 16th and 17th century had a different stereotype about women from what we have today. If our stereotype about women today is that women are the moral center of the home, they are the beacon of light that keep men and children in line. I mean, this is the plot of every Super Bowl commercial.
it must be true.
Right, so it must be true. So, but that idea is actually of relatively recent vintage, that stereotype about women's morality.
Huh.
That actually comes from the late 19th century. The stereotype about women in the 1600s and 1700s was just the opposite. It held that we were naturally lustful and wanton. We are in need of male guidance, both in the form of, say, a father or of a husband, in order to protect ourselves from our natural inclination and temptation into sin.
You chronicle the stories of several different women and different trials. In looking at these primary texts, did you start to see a pattern emerge about the kind of woman that was always accused?
Definitely. Typically, the woman who was accused as a witch was a woman at middle age. And middle age for them was the same as for us, incidentally, so 40s to 60s. But they also were marginal in some capacity. Perhaps they did not have children, which was very unusual at that time. Perhaps they had had an unfortunate marriage. One of the women in the Penguin Book of Witches had a husband who absconded with her money and left her destitute. Or perhaps you were a woman who expressed anger in a time when that was not widely looked upon. And one of the early skeptical writers in the Penguin Book of Witches, Reginald Scott, he writes in Discovery of Witches, why is it if we think that witches get all this extra power from the devil, how come the women who are tried are typically bleary-eyed, poor, disempowered, You would think that if you'd traded your soul to the devil, you would be beautiful and rich and successful.
Why is there such an appetite for a book like this still today? What is it about the supernatural and the idea of witches in particular, women and witchcraft, that so preoccupies us still?
I think there are two sides to that question. And one side clearly has to do with the question of scapegoating. It fills us with tremendous anxiety because we want to believe that we are a culture that is tolerant of religious difference, that is kind to people who are vulnerable in the community. And Salem is chilling. Witch trials in general, but Salem especially, is chilling because it reminds us how fragile those ideals really are. Because here's a case of 19 people being put to death by the state for a crime that a generation later would be held to be imaginary. So part of it, I think, has to do with the interest in that and the anxiety around scapegoating and how easy it is to do that. But the flip side of that coin has to do with power. What made witches dangerous in the early modern period makes them enticing now. Here is a case of a figure, a person, a woman generally, laying claim to power that does not belong to her, that should belong only to God or should belong only to people in authority. And she's taking that power for herself. And so that upending of the social order in the early modern is intolerable. And yet today is kind of attractive and exciting because who among us would not want to find a secret reservoir of power within ourselves? Who among us doesn't want to be in our cupboard under the stairs and be delivered a letter by an owl that tells us that we have secret powers we never understood before?
Catherine Howe, she is the editor of the new compilation of historical texts called The Penguin Book of Witches. Thanks so much for talking with us, Catherine.
Thanks so much for having me, and have a great Halloween.
Happy Halloween.
Diane von Furstenberg was a young socialite when she first started showing her designs to New York boutiques and magazine editors in the late 1960s. But the dresses she created weren't very expensive, and they definitely weren't couture.
It's a dress that was practical and pretty and sexy. Somebody said to me that it's a dress that you get the man with it, but he doesn't mind taking you to his mother.
It was the wrap dress, made of gentle jersey, gorgeously patterned with a deep V-neck and light belt. It sold by the millions, and von Furstenberg has been idolized by women ever since. But in her new memoir, The Woman I Wanted to Be, von Furstenberg says she idolized her mother. She was a Belgian Holocaust survivor named Lily, who rarely spoke to her daughter about her time in Nazi concentration camps.
She had tattooed numbers on her arm, but she had it removed because people kept on looking at it. And when she did talk about it, she protected me. So she would only talk about, you know, the good souvenir, if I can say. She talked about the friendship she had, and she didn't want to burden me with the heaviness of it all.
What kind of woman was she?
My mother was very minute. She was small and very slender, but she was probably the strongest person I ever met. I mean, she was very strict. She was, today one would say maybe she was a tiger mom, but I am glad she was like that because she built my character.
So you describe some pretty intense teasing on her part. I mean, she wasn't just strict, but, you know, you talked about her having this joke about having found you as an abandoned child.
In the garbage.
In the garbage.
Yeah, yeah,
you,
yeah.
You write over this very lightly. But
well, you know, I never questioned my mother. I just tried always to make it easier for her because even though she wouldn't show me her scars, you know, she was wounded. And I knew that. And therefore, I always was a good little girl and trying to please her at all costs. And so I never, ever questioned anything about her.
She's one of a key example of the kind of woman you wanted to be. There are also moments in the book where you talk about the kind of woman you did not want to be. And in that, I'm thinking about this cover story that ran about you and your first husband, the late Egon von Furstenberg, in New York Magazine. And at the time, this profile kind of created this image of you two being this very cosmopolitan, worldly couple. But you wrote that you didn't want to be a European Park Avenue princess with a pretend decadent life.
Right. No, it's just that, you know, we were very young, Egon and I, and good looking, and he was a prince and I was a princess. And when I actually read the article, that it was a cover story and it says the couple that has everything is everything enough. Somehow when I read that, I just thought, you know, that's not really who I am. And therefore, I can't really be a couple. I have to be me. And that, in a sense, made us separate. I don't know if it's the only reason, probably not, but it was kind of the turning point. But we stayed very, very good friends. It's just that I did not want to be married.
Was part of it also the image of being dependent on someone? I mean, it seems like that runs counter to the lessons your mom would have imparted to you.
Yeah, well, I never wanted to be dependent on anyone, whether it was my father or my husband. You know, when I was a little girl, a young girl, I did not really know what I wanted to do. But I did know the kind of woman I wanted to be. And I wanted to be an independent woman, a woman who is in the driving seat, who is in charge of her own life. And that clearly means also being financially independent. So that's really what I wanted to be. And I became that woman. I was lucky that I became that woman very, very early in life, you know, in my late 20s. And that's that.
You mentioned how your business really took off. And of course, you landed the cover of Newsweek before the age of 30. And at the time, you seemed comfortable. And in the book, you describe yourself, you know, as a tycoon. But you're reluctant to call yourself a designer until really much later. When did that change for you? And what was the reluctance?
Well, it's not reluctance. It's humility. You know, I worked in this mill for this Italian man who taught me everything. And then I made a few samples and then I brought them to America. You know, I made easy little dresses. That's what I did. I didn't think I was actually designing them and I didn't think I was making a fashion statement. Yet, this year I celebrated the 40th anniversary of my famous wrap dress. And I sold millions of them, and generations of women have worn it. So all of a sudden, it just hit me. I said, maybe I did not want to make a fashion statement, yet I did. And it was actually more than just a fashion statement. It turned out that it was a sociological. So I guess then now I am accepting it.
It also, in some ways, is tied to the sexual revolution, right? It's a dress that doesn't have any snaps or zippers or...
That's right.
It's something
you could take it out and slip in and out of it with making no noise.
Was that the intent as well? And what did your mother think of that?
None of it was the intent, but it was a reality.
You know, you once said that you were a prisoner of the wrap dress. And can you remember the moment when you forgave it, when you really embraced it the way you are now?
No, it's not that I was a prisoner. It's just that I took it for granted, that little dress, even though it paid for all my bills, it paid for my children's education, it paid for my houses, it paid for everything, my fame, my success. But, I mean, the moment this year that I decided that I was going to honor it, I looked at it in a completely different way, and I looked at it not just what it had done for me, but what, you know, its place in society and how incredible and rare that is that a dress lives that long. So now I am totally proud of it.
In the end, do you feel your mother's influence and sensibility kind of hanging over this success? I mean, do you feel like this is part of her legacy to you?
I am totally. I mean, she used to say that I was her torch of freedom, and I feel it. You know, I feel that I carry in my hand the flame of freedom, the flame of something that was taken away from her. And she did survive it, and she wasn't supposed to have a child, and I was born, so my birth was a miracle. So it is, to some degree, my duty to honor my mother and honor her sufferings with a lot of joie de vivre, because at the end, life had won.
Well, Diane von Furstenberg, thank you so much for speaking with us and best of luck on this next chapter.
Thank you.
Diane von Furstenberg, her memoir, The Woman I Wanted to Be, is out next week.